dear friends and intended large medal chiefs would speak to their people and prevent them from taking the same unconstructive attitudes as they had today. The two Indians listened impassively, but it seemed to Erasmus that the quality of their stillness had deepened with the mention of the ships. After a long, reflective pause, Captain Alec asked for the governor's words about medal chiefs to be more fully explained to them, as they had not heard of this matter before. Nor had Erasmus, but he realized at once that this must be what the superintendent had been so archly mysterious about earlier. Watson began to speak now with the utmost solemnity. The great white king had provided special medals to be bestowed upon those of his red children that showed friendship for their English brothers. These medals showed the great king's face, and they were of bronze. Some were as big as a man's palm, and they were intended for the most important men, who would be known as large medal chiefs. Some were smaller, about the size of a dollar. These medals, both large and small, were to be hung round the necks of those who had shown their love for the great king. This would be done in a special ceremony, before all the headmen of the nation. The Creeks listened to this intently, but without further comment. After further assurances of friendship, they took a dignified leave. Before Mr. Forrest left, he was instructed by the governor, on whom he knew his trade in liquor would in future depend, to move among the Creeks, and whenever he heard differences of policy among them, to point out the value of English friendship and the line they should take next day at the conference.
"We must leave no stone unturned," Campbell said on parting that night. "An interpreter moves in both worlds. He has an aura about him. He inspires trust."
He looked at Erasmus with his small, canny smile, the twinkle in his eyes as relentless as ever.
"These are cunning fellows we're dealing with, Mr. Kemp, and we must try to match them, however much it goes against the grain."
Chapter 45. It was deemed inadvisable, in Watson's view, for Erasmus to attend the next day's meeting. In the present delicate stage of negotiations, his presence there might have seemed like an attempt at conciliation, and as such taken as a mark of weakness, so he had to wait until the evening before learning the result of the governor and superintendent's combined diplomacy. He saw at once that things had gone well. Both men showed their satisfaction in ways peculiarly characteristic. Campbell with an air of preternatural shrewdness, Watson more orotund of phrase than ever, and with a tendency to rub his long-fingered hands together. There had been a dramatic reversal of attitude on the part of their two dinner guests, both of whom had spoken in favour of granting all the land east of the river, and even some on the west side, and this, coming from such respected and influential figures, had found general support among the chiefs. "They must have talked half the night, sir, after leaving us," Watson said. "Character will show in the end. They have no firmness of purpose, none at all. I've seen it before. They try to impose upon us. They see it is of no avail, and that we are people that cannot be intimidated. Then comes the fear of losing what they had thought we would be coerced to give. We seize the moment to make some special offer. Result?" He made fluttering gestures with his hands. "Capitulation, sir," he said. "Absolute and total." His large yellowish teeth were exposed in a smile, the first Erasmus could remember seeing on his face. "I have transported those medals all over the southern states of America," he said. "And they weigh, sir. They are deuced heavy."
"We will present the treaty tomorrow, and there is reason now to think they will sign it," Campbell said. "And a good piece of business it will be for England, and King George, God bless him, and I hope our services will be recognized."
On the following day, at Fort Picolata, 30 of the principal men of the Lower Creek Nation put their marks against their names, and the whole of the land, from the coast to the river and southwards to its source, was made available for settlement. Large medals were then bestowed upon Talachia, Captain Alec, and another chief named Estime, who had supported the English cause, while Wiofke, Lachigi, and Chehagi were all made small medal chiefs. This was done in a solemn ceremony, the superintendent presenting the chiefs to the governor, who hung the medals about their necks, while the guns of the fort sounded out, repeated by those on board the East Florida schooner. That evening, at the residence, there was a celebratory dinner to which all the chiefs were invited. The governor, resplendent in scarlet and gold, made a speech in which he declared that Florida would be held by the crown in perpetuity and that he looked forward to a long and fruitful cooperation between the red men and their white brothers. Palachia, his large medal shining on his chest, replied for the assembled chiefs. He was Tama, Flame of Tongue, and he was glad to hear the words of the governor. He hoped that blankets would soon be given to the people, as it was getting cold, and one blanket was not enough. These remarks were greeted by the assembled chiefs with deep, guttural exclamations of agreement. The superintendent then congratulated the medal chiefs, both large and small, and said that all the people of the Creeks, whether or not they had been honoured with medals, had acquired that day a friend and father in the Great White King. In point of fact, the Great White King was just then embarking on policies destined to lose him the whole of North America within 2 decades and bring about the total destruction of the Creek nation. He had begun already to talk rather rapidly and incoherently at times, and his urine had started to show a dark red colour, mystifying to his physicians. At around midnight, the chiefs left in a body, many by this time unsteady on their feet, and some needing to be helped on to their horses by the young braves who had been waiting in the compound of the residence. Watson, who had a weak stomach and not much liking for festivities in any case, had retired at an early stage, and the garrison officers now returned to their quarters, Redwood flushed and staring with what he had drunk, but still sufficiently in command of himself. In leaving, he expressed to Campbell his belief that the medal chiefs would find their trophies useful some day in stopping the bullets of their English brothers, a remark the governor found in questionable taste. His departure left Erasmus and Campbell alone together. Neither of them was yet inclined to retire for the night. Neither had drunk more than moderately, sharing a certain kind of abstemiousness and a dislike for any loss of control. Both men in their different ways were in happy mood, though Erasmus was aware that matters had still to be settled with regard to his expedition.
"This is a great occasion, Kemp," Campbell said. "Let us have a drop more brandy. We can go into my study. It is more comfortable there."
This was the room where the conduct of the negotiations had been plotted with Watson, and the pages of Campbell's uncompleted report still covered the desk.
"A historic occasion," the governor said, when they were settled in armchairs. "We have gained all we asked, and more. His Majesty's province of East Florida now includes all the sea coast as far as the tide flows, and all the country eastward of the river from its source to its entrance to the sea. I must say that Watson managed that matter of the medals consummately well. He and I have had our differences, but I have to admit that his sense of timing was impeccable." "He knows his business, so much is certain," Erasmus said. "He has had the happy thought, which he explained to me tonight before retiring, of holding back some of the goods promised to the Indians, keeping them in storage for a few months. Where would be the virtue in that? At present they know what we give them is in the nature of a reward. If, a little later, they see us give presents and ask for nothing in return, it will bind them closer to us. If Watson ever needs a post in the City of London, he can have one. He'd be just the man to deal with our shareholders." The governor sipped at his brandy. "The best of it is that we have been able to keep within the limits set by the Board of Trade," he said.
He glanced quickly at Erasmus, and a look of simple happiness appeared on his small, cautious face, as if he had reverted suddenly to some triumph of boyhood. He said,
"There were £400 allotted for the expenses of the conference, excluding the cost of provisions, and we have kept it to £380.16.08. I shall be making out the invoices first thing tomorrow. I trust their lordships at the Board of Trade will take note of it."
Watching Campbell's face, listening to his self-congratulatory tones, Erasmus knew that the time had come to extract a definite promise. The fire of his purpose had been burning all this while, but lo, the governor's simple pleasure at having cash in hand was fresh kindling, highly combustible. Erasmus felt the flames curl around it and leap. In throwing off hints about land deals, he had been misjudging Campbell. The governor was not a man of vision like himself. He was too cautious, too parsimonious. He would be interested more in the immediate prospect.
"I'm delighted at your success," he said, "and this infant colony has all my good wishes. With you at the helm, Colonel Campbell, she is set fair. Now that things are satisfactorily concluded here, I shall be able to leave shortly for the south of the peninsula. In fact, I shall be ready to go as soon as the troops and guns are made available to me. He saw an immediate shadow fall over Campbell's face. The governor set down his glass carefully, and Erasmus noticed for the first time that the backs of his small, strong hands were covered with wiry-looking reddish hairs.
"That needs some studying," Campbell said. "There are the redskins still to be reckoned with."
"They will go their separate ways, surely, when the presents have been given out. Think, sir, of the contribution you'll be making to the coffers of the new colony, and just at this time when money is so sorely needed."
"You have lost me now." A look of alertness had come to Campbell's face. "What contribution do you speak of?"
"Sir, what would happen if I could not rely on you for the soldiers? I would have to recruit and arm irregulars from Georgia. Half the profits would go to a parcel of mercenary rogues who have no ounce of scruple of patriotism among them."
"Profits? I'm slow tonight," Campbell said. "Perhaps it is the brandy."
"No, sir. As a military man and a servant of the Crown, you naturally do not take a view of private advantage. You have not fully considered the implications of this business. If my calculation is right, and my inquiries here have yielded some confirmation, there might be upwards of 100 down there in this upstart colony within your own, including women and children. They will have been breeding. The great majority will be black or mulatto. At Charlestown, an adult slave in good condition, it makes no difference whether black or mulatto, will fetch £50 for a man and 38 for a woman at current prices. Children over the age of 10 fetch good prices in proportion. The cost of transporting the cargo to South Carolina will not be great. It takes no great head for figures to see that there is a lot of money for the man who gets them to market. Now, if the capture were made by troops, acting on your orders, you could make claim to it. For the royal coffers, of course."
"Of course.
And if any of the men are lost in the action, it will be viewed as acceptable in such a cause." Erasmus was silent for a short while. Then he said, in a thoughtful, reflective tone, "I should say there is something like 2,500 guineas in it. Clear profit."
He met now the full regard of the governor's small, keen eyes, with their misleading twinkle still in evidence.
"Do I understand you to say that you do not want the money?" Campbell said, in the softer voice he used for moments of emotion. "I did not say that. The negroes were purchased by my father, and I will recover some of his investment. I shall expect to reimburse myself for the expense I have been put to, and I shall expect a half share in the proceeds of the sale. I am aware that these are liberal terms, but my interest is not entirely financial. The people of that ship are murderers and thieves. The black men and women and all their offspring are stolen property. I want the former brought to justice and the latter recovered and sold. I have personal reasons, their nature I won't discuss, but they are compelling. The years have changed nothing. How could they?"
His tone had quickened in speaking. He experienced now a faint shuddering in his lower jaw and realized that he had set his teeth too close in the stress of his feeling.
"I have money enough," he continued more calmly. "I would be content to sign over to you one half of my rights in the cargo, subject to a deduction for expenses, say £350, in exchange for your official countenance and your help in the matter of the men and guns. We can see to the papers. It is a simple enough matter."
Campbell nodded and glanced aside, compressing his mouth to a thin line. He reflected for some moments, then said,
"I respect your motives, sir. They assure you to be a man of both sense and feeling. But you must realize my position here. There may be loss of life among the troops if these people make resistance. There may even be damage to the cannon, a serious matter, for which I would be held accountable. Under the circumstances, will you not reconsider? I would think it more reasonable if you were to deduct expenses after the sale, from your half share, rather than before."
"Sir," Erasmus said, "any loss or damage would be favourably viewed, since it would have occurred in the course of smoking out a nest of vipers in the heart of His Majesty's province. That is the kind of energetic action that brings a man to the notice of his superiors. They will think better of you for it than for saving them a few pounds and shillings on the conference expenses. However, I don't wish to appear unreasonable. As I say, my interest is not only financial. I will lower my figure for expenses by £100, but it must still be deductible before the sale of the negroes. Come now. That is the best offer I can make you."
Campbell's face still showed some reserve. With a sense of timing rivaling that of the masterly Watson, Erasmus chose this moment to say, with studied nonchalance,
"It would be a private matter between us, of course. I would not ask for any accounting. I would take my half in cash, if possible, or in bills of credit, and the other half would be made over to you, together with all receipts and records of the sale. I'm content to leave the matter in your hands for the better governance of this new colony of Florida."
"Sir," Campbell said, "here's my hand on it. Give me 3 days. The creeks will be drunk for that time on the rum we shall give them, and our full force will be needed in case of disturbance. After that, they will disperse. 3 days, and the men and the guns will be placed at your disposal. You have my word."
They drank to this, and shook hands again, before parting for the night. Alone in his room, Erasmus lay hot and sleepless, excited by thoughts of lawful profit and just retribution. His plans had knitted together most wonderfully. Somewhere to the south of him, Matthew Paris was lying at this moment, asleep or awake, with no knowledge of the nemesis that was drawing near. He had no doubt now that his cousin was there, was alive, was waiting, he too, though unconsciously, for this last act to be played out between them. The nightmare fears that Paris might be dead or somehow beyond his reach had gone now. Paris was necessary to the completeness of things, to the workings of justice, and so he must be there. It was a faith almost childlike, and all the faces that came now to visit him in the darkness confirmed it in one way or another. His father's faces, living and dead, the actor in the shipyard sniffing at the fatal timbers, the flushed and handsome dominator of conversation, the staring creature in the candlelight. Sarah's face came too, stately as Miranda, calm with love, then with tears on the cheeks and some ultimate accusation in the eyes. His wife's grotesque masks floated before him, and his mother's face of recovered health, which he had never been able to forgive. Last, eclipsing the others, the laughing face of the youth who had lifted him away. Yes, the days were numbered now for Cousin Matthew. "You will hang by the neck, as my father did," he promised that laughing face. Lying there in the dark, he could feel the noose tightening round his cousin's throat, feel it so surely that it was like a constriction of his own breathing.
Part 9, Chapter 46. The passage of Erasmus's ship up the coast towards St. Augustine had been observed by Hughes the climber, who also noticed the unusual length of time she dallied at anchor. He was high in the branches of a gum resin tree in a jungle cluster surrounding a freshwater pool where white-tailed deer came to drink. He had been waiting for the deer since early morning. He saw the ship in the distance, and noted by old habit the set of her sails. Two square topsails, fore and aft rig, she was a schooner. He had grown accustomed over the years to the fleeting sight of sails on the horizon. High-bowed Spanish merchantmen bound for Cuba, an occasional frigate patrolling off the coast, the long Latin-rigged fishing canoes of the Indians. They showed their shapes to his indifferent gaze, drew away, and dissolved like a doubtful memory. Hughes was 54 now, and had long ceased wanting to be anywhere else. The purposes of his fellows did not much occupy his speculation. He had noticed that this ship stayed longer than she needed for taking water on, but he soon stopped thinking about her altogether, and fell to watching a woodpecker, with bright yellow wing feathers, feeding in the branches of a tree some 20 yards away. He watched with close interest the movements of its feet and beak as it swung to get at the clusters of small red berries. Any life before his eyes that was not human could absorb his attention for hours. Inviolate here, high in the branches, his rope ladder drawn up and coiled on the lashed driftwood of the platform, he felt the solitude like an accustomed drug in his veins. Community life had come too late for Hughes, too late to soften much the savage misanthropy of his nature, but he could escape now into these empty places and the impulse of violence had quietened in him. He ranged far and wide, from the pinewood ridges near the shore to the swamps and jungle islands behind them and the great sea of sawgrass that stretched far inland from the settlement. He cultivated no ground, living on what he could kill or gather, bringing in skins sometimes to trade for food, going to Lamba, his woman, at irregular intervals. This last habit had caused trouble in early days, made worse by his demand for Lamba's immediate and total attention whenever he arrived. It violated established rules of sexual behaviour, which were founded on the woman's consent, and reflected on the dignity of the man he shared Lamba with, a negro known as Mando Tammy. The three had come to fighting over it, Tammy receiving a knife gash in his arm, which had to be stitched by Matthew Paris, and Hughes lucky to escape permanent damage to an eye from Lamba's nails. But habit is a skin that can grow over any shape, and they had reached a kind of understanding over the years. Hughes could not be brought to any concept of the mutual rights involved in sharing, but he was granted some latitude as a special case. It was never forgotten that he had once, by his vigilance, saved the settlement. He watched the woodpecker until it disappeared among the lower foliage, and then, with the same attention, a honey-coloured bee at the flowers of a smooth-barked tree which grew almost as tall as his own, ending some feet below his platform. He followed the movements of the bee as it clambered among the drooping white spikes of blossom, observing how the insect vibrated its body each time it entered one of the flowers. His mind moved slowly over possible explanation. Could the bee do this to help the flower spread its pollen? From time to time he glanced across the short space of clearing towards the black water below him. In this dry season, when the level sank below the roots of the sawgrass, the deer came more often to these pools in the jungle islands. He knew they came to this one. He had seen their traces in the soft earth at the edge and the nibbled-off tops of the spider lilies. The dark water mirrored with absolute fidelity the bushy cabbage palms standing nearby, and the spikes of air plants that grew on them, and the pale drapes of moss that hung over the surface. No faintest tremor marred these reflections for the moment. All was glassy calm, but Hughes knew that there was always danger in the vicinity of these jungle pools. Not only deer came to drink here, he had seen snake tracks and the pad marks of a panther at the edges. It was a good place to wait. At 40 feet above ground, he was not much troubled by mosquitoes. There was small need for camouflage. Deer almost never looked upward, and at that height his smell would be undetectable to them. His bow and cane arrows lay on the platform beside him. The bow was as tall as he was. He had cut and seasoned the wood himself and strung it with deer gut. He had to use his full strength to draw it. Most men in the settlement had adopted the Indian habit of pointing their arrows with sharpened fishbone, but Hughes preferred flint arrowheads, lengthening the shaft to balance the extra weight. He had become expert with the weapon. At this range, if he caught the deer drinking, he could break its neck with a single shot. An instant kill was better, there was more respect in it, and the meat was sweeter when the beast had died without fear. Sooner or later, perhaps in the early evening, they would come stepping through the trees. Meanwhile, he was content to wait. More than content. There was, in this exercise of patience, the nearest thing to happiness that Hughes had ever known. The feeling lay far below his capacity for words, but it was as if the casual elements of his surroundings, the foliage and the dark water and the bright air and the life of small creatures around him, were freed by his waiting to be truly themselves. In early afternoon, it rained a little. There had been a succession of similar days. The mornings began warm and clear, then towards midday clouds gathered in the east and drew rapidly across the sky. Out to sea, the shafts of rain squalls were visible, shaped like inverted fans and imbued with a smoky radiance. These spread to the land, and there were showers of rain, sometimes heavy. By mid-afternoon, the skies were clear again, without visible stain, and the sun shone as warmly as ever. At this season, clouds formed and dissolved casually. The rain was like a brief smudge of breath on a clear window, bringing no consequence, leaving no trace. Hughes leaned back against the trunk, drew up his legs, and sat still under the rain. Afterwards, a faint steam rose from the wet leaves. Before they were properly dry, he saw a hunting spider lower itself on an invisible thread and come to rest directly before his face. This type of spider he had seen before. They made no web, but hunted their prey through the foliage and among the litter in the clefts of the branches. He leaned slowly and carefully forward and looked at the creature closely. Its eyes were saucer-shaped, unmoving. When he looked into them, he saw there a pulsing, flashing light. It was as if a shutter were being drawn rapidly back and forth over some brightness at the back of the eye. Another person who saw the ship pass was Temka Tongman. He was paddling out to his fish nets in the reedy verges of an inlet a mile or so down the coast from the settlement. He paid little attention to the passing vessel. His mind was on the palaver, due to be held in some days' time, at which he had agreed to be the speaker for Bulum Iboti, who was accused of practising witchcraft. Tongman's abilities as a speaker were widely recognised. He owed his name to them. He was thinking now of the fact that Iboti, a notoriously unlucky man, had agreed to pay him in labour instead of the acorn flour he had offered at first. Tongman had no need for acorn flour, but he wanted ground cleared for planting pumpkins and sweet potatoes, both of which grew well in the rich soil at the edges of the freshwater lagoons. Iboti had agreed to clear 50 paces by 10 of roots and vines if he won the case. Naturally, there would be no fee if he lost. Two witnesses had seen them strike hands together.
"Dat 10-day work, Iboti," he said aloud. "Where you from?"
Tongman liked the sound of his own voice, and in these lonely places he often talked to himself. After 12 years, Pigeon came more naturally to him than the Temne he had spoken as a child. He had been surprised when his client agreed to complete the work, rather than simply promising a fixed number of days. Iboti could have got away with half of the time. He was not merely unlucky, he was foolish too. Perhaps it was the same thing. Tongman was a dealer by instinct. A settled, sedentary man, wily of speech. As he paddled out through the narrow channels in the mangroves into the ruffled, gleaming expanse of open water, he wove a golden future for himself. He would exchange the surplus of his vegetables for the salt and flint that more adventurous spirits like Kavana and Tiamoko, working in partnership, brought down from the north. Salt and flint were goods that could be kept indefinitely until the time came when shortage would increase demand. His net broke the water. A large green-mottled lizard fish thrashed in the depths of it, its long jaws snapping to show the rows of teeth.
"This fish palaver too much," Tongman said. "Look at me, Bad Yai. I got the answer for you, my friend."
He took up a short club from the floor of the canoe and gave the lizard fish a blow on the head with it, stilling its movements instantly.
"Where dat Bad Yai now?"
He was pleased to find the silver-blue fish with the big fleshy lump on its forehead, which he knew from the rivers of home.
"You come a long way. Got a big head. Live a long time. Finish now. Only one time fish can die. Same as man."
He felt confident he could win the case. He had made his own inquiries and had a surprise witness whom he had sworn to secrecy. All the same, there were aspects of the business that worried him, the main one being the identity of Iboti's accuser. Shanti Hambo was a fellow tribesman of Danka, one of the men with whom Tongman traded, and more importantly, of Kireku, whom it was better to have for a friend than an enemy. These three were all the Shanti that had survived, but they formed a powerful group, and they had begun to claim their male children, which was contrary both to rule and custom. The net was in now. Apart from the big parrotfish, it had not been a good catch. But there were two baitfish, which he knew from the strong, brassy lustre of their colouring. They were not good to eat, but they were full of oil and could be chopped and scattered to attract the big black and silver food fish that lay in the deep water of the creek mouths. This he remembered doing in another life, on a wider, swifter river. Tongman had been a boy of 14 when he was caught by a slaving party and sold aboard ship. His memories of childhood lay beyond the misery and terror of the voyage. They were thus in a charmed place, not altogether believed in, but vivid and piercing when they came, and curiously arbitrary too. He had remembered scattering bait on the bright, flecked surface of the Raketa River.
rocking in a dugout canoe not much different from this one, his father at the stern with a long spear. The memory was changeless. There was always the bright, eddying water, the crash of waves over the bar at the river mouth, the conical roofs of huts along the banks, and there were big white birds with forked tails that flew endlessly over the water. He could remember their quick shadows over the surface, but he could not remember hearing any sounds from these birds, nor ever seeing them settle. In his memory, they dipped and wheeled, forever in total silence. Past and present were also interfused in an argument taking place on the outskirts of the settlement at more or less the same time, between Billy Blair and the negro named Inchebi.
"Oh, Billy, Billy, I so sorry for you, I ready for cry,"
Inchebi said, shaking his head from side to side and blinking sorrowfully.
"You don't know the shit of the fire from the burning of the fire. That you great trouble, man."
He was small and coal-black, with a mobile, slightly twisted face, very quick and delicate in all his movements. Blair's frayed and battered palm-leaf hat dipped over his brows, and the lower part of his face was hidden by a fair, curly beard, but his blue eyes were wrathful as ever, wide now with the furious protest with which he greeted all the manifold contradictions and failures of logic in the world.
"You talkin' big, big rubbish, Chibi, my son," he said. "You ought to get a telling me you got stone make rain? You want me believe you knock bloody stone together make rain? That on my arse and Betty Morton!"
One of Inchebi's great strengths in argument, and it was one peculiarly infuriating to Billy, was that he never sought to persuade. He radiated always a placid, unassertive confidence of being in the right.
"What you believe you business," he said. "I tellin' truth."
Both men were somewhat out of temper. They had spent most of the day trying to shoot turkey in the swamps without any success, stumbling and slipping in pursuit of that most wily and sagacious of birds, making gobbling noises in the vague hope of drawing one to them. All they had got were two small squirrels, hardly enough for a stew. In such situations they each tended to lay the blame on the other. They were, in any case, on terms of exasperated familiarity, owing to the fact that they shared the same woman. Salian Kivi had grown very fat, and had never been a beauty, but she was a good-tempered woman, very faithful by nature, and an excellent cook. She had been content for 10 years now with these two.
"I hear you talkin' big mouth dink a merry," Billy said. "Say how you got rainstone. Make yourself out big rain, man."
Inchebi returned no answer to this, merely gazing around him with his small, bright eyes. Billy, too, was silent for a while, as if baffled. Of late years, a habit of suspended consciousness had grown in him. At any time, when he was alone or with others, or even as now in the midst of argument, there would come a certain kind of hush over things. Everything before him would seem fixed somehow, arrested. Accompanying this was a kind of perplexity at the strangeness, the ultimate illogicality of his being where he was. He felt this now as he looked away towards the first huts of the settlement. Only the sloping thatches of the roofs were visible from here. The rest was concealed behind the stockade of palm logs that encircled the whole area. He and Inchebi were standing outside this, lower down, on a track that led through thin forest. Some children were playing together up against the stockade, and two women stood talking nearby. Beyond them, in the distance, he saw the hulking form of Libby go past, carrying what looked like fencing for a fish trap. Probably on some errand for Kireku, he thought with faint contempt.
"Dinka never go believe you," he said. "She not born yesterday. She sabi you just try and get your leg over."
Inchebi was unmoved.
"I not born yesterday, never. I sabi you try and get your leg over."
Dinka was young, 22 or 23, it was computed, tall and graceful, scornful of smile but melting of eye. She was visited by a man of the Bullum, middle-aged and taciturn, known to everyone by the single name of Amos. But her regular man had failed to return from a fishing trip and was now presumed drowned.
"You jalouse, Billy," Inchebi said. "That what it is."
Billy feigned laughter. The floppy brim of his hat nodded up and down.
"Me jalouse? Dat a good un? Ho, ho! Look de big portent rain man of Africa. 'Prentice man. What you say? I 'prentice rain man.
Aha! Billy's eyes shone with triumph. Dat a different song, he said. Dat not what you tell Dinka.
At this moment, Sullivan came up the track and joined them. He was carrying a palm fibre basket, three-quarters full of freshwater mussels.
Well, me brave lads, he said, will you look at this now?
He took up a handful of mussels and let them slide off his palm into the basket, watching the clattering blue shells with eyes that were hallucinated-looking in the deep tan of his face. Sullivan was a great man for mussels and clams and knew all the best places. Gathering them, he was sometimes taken back to his childhood in Galway, foraging for shellfish in the salt recesses of this same ocean. He was naked, except for his deerskin moccasins and a breech-clout of braided palm leaves, and he smelled of the fish oil he had rubbed on himself against mosquitoes. His black hair fell almost to his shoulders and was held off his face by a band of fibre tied across the forehead.
"You make swap," he said, reverting to pigeon at the prospect of trade. "You make me good swap, 5-pint measure mussel. What you got?"
Neither Billy nor Inchebi said anything. Sullivan regarded the two small, limp squirrels hanging head downwards from Billy's rope belt.
"That all?"
Billy looked away from the mussels with assumed indifference.
"The time come for truth," he said doggedly to Inchebi. "You tell Dinka you got rainstone, you show me them rainstone. Where they?"
Inchebi turned to Sullivan, twisting his mouth and widening his small, expressive eyes.
"You hear this man? He think Rain Man carry cargo rainstone aboard all de time."
He turned a pitying glance back at Billy.
"They kept secret place close water," he said. "No tell where. Anyone know anything about rainstone, know dat. Why you care so much what pinion Dinka have? Dat no secret, I tell you why. You want get in Dinka bed, get your leg over."
"For the love of God," Sullivan said. His face had assumed an expression of astonishment. His green eyes glanced after a lost vision of human reason and decency.
"You fella sniffin' after dat no good Dinka when you got a so-so jewel at home. Yeah, dat right I talkin' about you Sallyin. She cook good too much. She fuck much you want. She never naggy. What man do when he got woman like dat? I tell you what. He treasure dat woman. He put de grapple on dat woman. He climb aboard and stay aboard."
At this point he found himself being regarded closely by Inchebi, who was more devious than Billy and so more prone to suspicion.
"We glad too much get your idea on dis subject," he said.
It was known to everyone that Sullivan, by one of those shifts of fortune sometimes occurring in the settlement, where relations between the sexes were a complex blend of the casual and the binding, now found himself having to share his woman with two others.
"You say Dinka no good," Inchebi said. "Maybe you think Dinka not beautiful girl, not have beautiful butties and so on and so forth. What you say?"
This was a very cunning question, and Sullivan, aware that he had possibly overdone Sallyan's praises, was thrown out by it.
"Tim things you mention is steadily deteriorating," he said. "Any man with a knowledge of commerce, like myself, will tell you it is no earthly use investing your money in a deteriorating asset."
Some of Inchebi's calm fell away from him.
"What shit lingo dat?" he said. "You want say me something? You talk people lingo."
"Beautiful bodies, what dat matter?"
Sullivan said earnestly.
"You fella lucky have so ugly woman. Beautiful go away soon, never come back. Ugly go on getting more and more."
He cast about for a way of changing the subject.
"What you talk about?" he said. "Sallyan look after you so good, you like twin. You like bun same oven, one bake bit longer."
This was a true observation. Both men were short and quick of movement, and both were dressed identically in clothes that had been made for them by Sallyan. A tactful and loving woman, she made no distinction of any kind between them. They had exactly the same palm-leaf hats, deerskin drawers decorated with plaited fibre tassels dyed red, and sleeveless smocks of faded blue, made from a remnant of cotton from the trade goods that had been brought off the ship.
"Subject not Dinka, subject not Sallyan," Billy said austerely. "Subject not bloody twins. We talking about rainstone. Easy too much no tell where. Oh, yes, last rain come late. Why you no knock stone to get a fall rain before?
De time no right."
"What you mean time no right? That de time people need."
"Rain no come for people need. No care bugger people need. Aha! I got you in a corner now, Chibi! Billy's expression was again triumphant. I got you pinned down! You wait, you see rain come, then you knock stone!
Inchebi nodded placidly.
Certainly, he said. Dat de right time knock stone.
He raised a thin forefinger.
But only Rain Man can see dat.
He right.
Sullivan had begun to take an interest in the argument.
Why the pox man knock stone if rain no come?
Jesus, you bad as he is.
Billy felt himself sweating. There was a contradiction of appalling proportions at the heart of Inchebi's argument, but he could not see it clearly enough to be able to expose and refute it. He raised his heated face to an uncomprehending sky.
Give me strength, he said.
Sullivan was shaking his head slowly.
Hey, bejabbers, wasted effort, he said. Where de point in dat?
Suddenly, Billy saw a way.
Tell me this, then. How you know dey the right stones?
What you mean?
How you find them? You no born with stone, eh? Only stone you born with is you ball. Or maybe you Rain Man, baby, you knock you ball together, Mark Rain.
Inchebi greeted this with dignified silence.
Well then, Billy went on, you got to look here, look there, find a good stone, right or wrong.
Right.
Got you now.
Billy paused, savouring his triumph.
One bloody stone like another. How you know you stoned the right one?
Inchebi looked at him with genuine astonishment.
What kind question dat? Dey de wrong stone? Rain no come down.
Chapter 47. On his return, happening to pass Matthew Paris, Hughes mentioned the ship and the fact that she had anchored overnight. Most things came to Paris's ears sooner or later. The people of the crew reported to him out of habit, and a kind of deference that had survived the familiarity of the years, and both Black and White confided in him sometimes when he was treating them for sickness or injury or discontent in the long palm thatch lean-to on the edge of the compound that he used for a sick room. He thought for a while about what Hughes had told him as he sat there at the corner of his hut on a low stool he had made out of driftwood, with his hat tilted forward against the low sun and his naked, long-shanked legs stretched out before him. He did not see anything very remarkable in a ship lingering a day or two longer than usual. There could be a score of reasons. That it was Hughes who had delivered the information was the only remarkable thing. In remote communities, legends form as imperceptibly as clouds change shape and colouring, and Hughes, while still alive amongst them, had become a legendary climber and watcher. This lonely man had saved them once, or so it was generally held, in the violent early days of the settlement, when the threads that held them all together had been stretched, taut, close to snapping. In the first rainy season it had happened, when the vast prairies of sawgrass lay under water. Hughes never spoke of it, taciturn in this, as in all else, but the words with which he had come to tell the others had always been remembered and repeated. Delblon, in particular, had seen from the first the importance of telling things over. He had been clear-sighted in those times of danger, always seeking to encourage a sense of unity among the fugitives, ready to seize on anything that could be celebrated by the whole people together. Delblon lay under the ground now, but this had been his legacy. Jimmy, the linguista, had aided this work, especially with the children. He had found his vocation as a teacher, though his school was very irregularly attended and subject to changes in the weather. He taught the children to form letters, and he taught them simple arithmetic, but his lessons were mainly storytelling and play-acting. He was helped sometimes by Paris, who had no idea of teaching, but would read extracts from his small stock of books. The children dozed or fidgeted to the sound of Pope and Hume. The years had stiffened Jimmy's back and thinned his wiry poll, so that the scalp showed through. His habit of smiling was unchanged, but in class, for the sake of drama, he would compel his face to seriousness, and this was effective, even sometimes fearsome, because of the contrast. He always began the Hughes story in the same way, speaking in his high, musical, rather plaintive voice, raising his hands and assuming a fixed stare so as to engage the children's attention.
One time, Ooze climbed this big tree. Ooze can climb anything. This tree go high in the sky too much. So big this tree.
Jimmy raised his arms and spread his fingers, looking up in a daze of wonderment at branches and foliage lost in the sky.
Now, why he do that?
A number of hands were raised immediately.
Ja, Sammy. Who's want get up top?
The simplicity of this answer occasioned some mirth. Sammy glanced round him, smiling, then slowly allowed his head to sink forward onto his hands.
Very good, my pickin', very good, Jimmy said. Never mind them sniggin ones. Easy to laugh. They laugh different by-and-by. You answer 100% right. You only four, but you a thinker. But there another reason come behind that one. Ja, Tekka.
Tekka was a strong, sardonic boy of nine, deep black in colour, with prominent cheekbones and bright, intrepid eyes. There was always a high shine on his face, as if it were kept polished.
Maybe black bear chase ooze up the tree, he said. Maybe black bear come after him, and ooze fraid lose him arse.
There was some laughter at this, spiced with a sense of sacrilege. It was the ambition of all the children to add in some way to the body of the story, and Jimmy sometimes admitted new material, but this attempt of Tekka's failed altogether.
No black bear, Jimmy shook his head, more in sorrow than in anger. No arse or any portion ooze natomy.
To assert authority or deal with subversion, he found it effective sometimes to use words outside the range of the children's pigeon. Besides, he enjoyed the sound of them in his mouth.
That not in the story, he said. Ja, Lamina.
Lamina, who was a little older than Sammy, had a mouth whose upper and lower lips were full and exactly symmetrical, forming the perfect shape of a flower. She always hesitated long over her answer, however eagerly she had thrust up her hand.
Who's want get up there for lookout? She said at last. That right, my pickin'. And when he get up there, what he see?
And so it would go on, from question to answer, both questions and answers known by heart, until Jimmy settled into the story in real earnest. And then it was just his voice, rising and falling, a sound that belonged there, like the hiss and crackle of evening fires, or the dry rustle of wind in the cabbage palms, while the children sat silently listening, all shades from ebony to dark sand, in the shade of the long fronds.
Ooze! He see like snippy bit colour. Maybe dey was colour, maybe dey was shine a white man face.
The climber hero, from his eminence there in the close-growing hummock, had found himself able to look down over a narrow valley, or canyon, rather, a long strip where the rock rose near the surface, giving lodgment only to low growths, palmetto and bush willow. Beyond this, mangroves marked the course of a creek which wound through swampland, taking its rise from the flooded sawgrass plain. In the distance, Hughes could see the winking rim of this vast lake. Through the lower leaves of the mangroves, in the long shaft of sunlight that lay along the defile before him, he glimpsed a flash of red, saw light reflected from broken water. He trained the ship's telescope, which had belonged once to Thurzo and was now common property, over the belt of barer ground to where the creek water glinted behind the screen of mangroves. He waited. Then, for a space of perhaps 15 seconds, before it was again hidden by denser foliage, he saw a long canoe pass downstream, a white man paddling at the prow in a ragged straw hat with a musket slung across his back. Behind him, huddled together on the centre thwarts, were three Indians, with faces painted or tattooed, he could not determine which, in this brief space of time. They sat with heads hanging, roped together, their arms bound behind them. Three more men, two of them negroes, all armed with muskets, sat in the stern. One of the negroes had a red kerchief tied round his head. It was this that Hughes had glimpsed through the screen of trees. This was the tale he had come back with. The long canoe, the armed men, the bound Indians. They were going towards the sea. But this creek would not take them far. Hughes knew that and reported it. It was a summer stream only, swollen by the rains, running out into the marshy edges of the lagoons. Perhaps they didn't know this, someone suggested, or perhaps they were not making for the sea at all, but looking for some great river they knew of, which would take them north, where they could sell their captives. That it was their intention to sell the Indians, everyone was agreed. There could be no other reason for taking men and binding them. Nothing much else was clear. At this time, the people of the settlement knew only their immediate surroundings. They knew the shore and the sheltering pine land and the swamps behind. They had not ventured far into the interior for fear of the Indians, who had already killed and mutilated Haines. Thus, they could form no idea of where the men had come from. But some of the crew remembered stories of whites and runaway Negroes banded together down among the Florida Keys, who lived by wrecking craft on the reefs and selling any Indians they caught to the Spanish.
"This the story Ooze come back with," Jimmy said. "Then the people talk together about this. Some dem say, 'Let canoe alone. Dem fella no danger to us. Come for take Indian, not us.' But Parry and Delba, they say no. Maybe some you member, Delba, he get sick, die after. And Fowler woman, Tabakali, say no. Anadri say no. Suppose them feather come back again, what then? But there another reason back behind this why they say no. Why them Indian in the canoe first place? Yeah, Kenka."
Kenka was a slender, tawny-skinned mulatto boy who often did not put up his hand even when he knew the answer, but Jimmy had learned to recognize the look on his face when he wanted to be asked and the tense position of his body. Jimmy knew, too, that Tabakali, the heroine of this debate, was Kenka's mother.
"They take Indian for slave," the boy said proudly. "That right. Take them for slave. That very important reason for help them. All people got a right to be free. Nadri say that, and Delba say that. You let them take slave, you stand one side. Let them take slave, you was slave yourself. You forget so quick."
Jimmy paused and smiled round at the children.
"I was there," he said. "Dem time people no talk pidgin like now. People talk lingo blong dem. I big linguista dem time."
It was not the first debate he had assisted in. That had been held on board the ship, blood still on the deck, Thurzo's body still warm. The children knew this story, too. Jimmy always went through all the stages of these famous debates, but he was a moralist, as teachers often are. He wanted to instill a sense of community in the children, so that there were certain aspects that he omitted to mention, or even falsified. His version of events was not necessarily that which lived in the memory of others who had taken part. People read into things their own truths and meanings, but everyone who had been present, and that was all of the fugitives, men and women, black and white, who had survived the voyage and the landing and the hardships of the first weeks, knew that the actions stemming from this debate had saved the settlement. One thing Jimmy always omitted was the naming of those unheroic ones who would have let the slaver takers go unmolested. Only Wilson was named. He took the burden of all. The others still walked the earth. Their offspring were among Jimmy's pupils, but Wilson had died in public view, disgraced and without issue, and so everything discreditable could be laid at his door. In the course of time, a legendary wickedness had gathered round Wilson's name. It had been his fate to become first scapegoat, then ogre. Now mothers sometimes hushed their children with the threat that Wilson would hear them and come. But in fact, there had been others to take his side in this debate. Libby had done so, and a big morose man from the Ivory Coast named Tiamoko. None of these had been able to see any point in intervening to save the Indians.
"Them Indians aren't nothing but savages,"
Libby said, his solitary eye staring furious and bloodshot.
"You seen what they done to Haines? They took the scalp off him while he was still alive. Them white fellas done me no harm. Why should I raise my hand again me own kin?"
It was then, when these remarks had been explained to her, that Tabakali, the Fulani woman, joined in the discussion. She spoke no pidgin at that time, but she was a bold, independent woman from a nomad people and had ranged far west along the Guinea coast, and she could speak some Malinke, which Jimmy was able to translate. He had not been able to do full justice to the contempt that rang in the words of this tall and magnificent woman, but enough of it came through even in the bare pidgin of his rendering.
"She say, 'What you mean raise your hand again, you kind? You kind slave taker? That what you mean? She say, in that case, you no belong here. You can get out.' Then she say, 'Haines killed stealing gold dust from de ship. Who weepin' for Haines? Barton sabi dat good, sabi different. He can speak now, we waitin'.'"
Barton had remained silent, everyone knew he had joined with Haynes in the ill-fated attempt to escape with the gold.
"She say, Libby makes sick she belly. She say, Libby missing one eye and both him ball. If Libby her man, but she thank great God he not, she put him out the door. She say, Wilson and Tiamoko same Libby."
"Hooray!"
Billy Blair said, delighted at this discomforting of his old enemy. But Wilson was not amenable to the rules of debate, had, moreover, an ugly temper. Not many weeks later, it was to be his death. He took two steps towards the woman.
"You black bitch," he said. "Is that calling me names? Stand back."
Without conscious thought, Paris had interposed himself. Wilson's darkly bearded face was on a level with his own, the eyes in their cavernous sockets curiously vacant and unseeing. "Stand back," he said again, though not loudly or threateningly. "This is a time for words, not blows. Or do you not know the difference?" he added with a sort of involuntary contempt. Wilson continued to look sullenly at him. He showed no sign of being cowed, but after a moment, perhaps sensing opinion was against him, he fell back. Paris turned and looked at the woman standing there. She had not given ground. She was wearing still the coarse cotton shift they had given her on the slave ship. The passion of her words had deepened her breathing. Her eyes flashed and her head was thrown back on the splendid column of her neck. Paris, who still had no woman at that time, was swept by a tide of admiration and desire more urgent than anything he had known, flooding his whole being like a sudden brimming of the vessel in which lay all the thoughts he had had of her from the very first when he had seen her behind the bars in the sunlit slave dungeon of the fort. He could not keep the feeling out of his eyes, and Tabakali saw it. But it was above all for Delblanc that this debate, the first one of the whole people together, was a turning point and a revelation. And the nature of this revelation did not feature in Jimmy's account either, because it was mainly concerned with Delblanc's knowledge of himself. He had seen at once that the Indians should be rescued. Such an act would assert the principles of freedom and natural justice on which he hoped to found this infant republic of his dreams. And it might well improve relations with the Indians, fear of whom, after the terrible death of Haynes, had kept them penned in this narrow space of woodland between the exposed shore and the flooded savannah behind. But he had seen further than this. With a perception colder than he had believed possible in himself, and herein lay the element of revelation, he had seen at once that what became of the Indians was in a way a secondary issue. The slave takers had to be killed in any case. It was their death that he argued for, with all the force at his command, speaking directly to Paris and the people of the crew, leaving Jimmy to make the best of it he could, knowing that the whites, though in a minority, were more cohesive, had a certain ascendancy still, which would not last long, but might be exploited now, knowing, too, that the intention to kill the men must be formed and stated here, not left to the chances of the pursuit. "We have no choice," he said. "It makes no difference what is decided about the Indians and what are the rights and wrongs of rescuing them. Personally, I think they should be rescued. But above all, the men who have taken them must be killed. Some of you have already said it. Suppose they come back. Suppose they have seen some of us. We cannot afford not to suppose it. They might return in more strength. Even if not, can we take the risk of stories about us being carried up and down the coast? You know we cannot. We must go after them now before they escape us." Delblanc was a man transformed. He was still wearing the waistcoat and breeches with which he had left the ship, torn and muddied now, but nothing else about him seemed the same. The years of vague theory, half-ironic rhetoric, generous egalitarian sympathy came together now in this focus of fierce clarity. More than he had wanted anything in his life, he wanted this desperate experiment to succeed. All the people before him, black and white, whether they knew it or not, had been enslaved. He intended now that they should live in peace and freedom, without coercion, in this untouched corner where they found themselves. Four lives seemed little against such a dream. To Paris, his friend's face had become unrecognizable almost, cold, preoccupied, and yet elated, too.
"You are talking about killing four men in cold blood," he said. "Yes, I am, of course I am.
Delblanc said, with a vehemence barely held in check.
"Don't be a fool, Matthew. Are you suggesting it should be left to the bungling of hot blood, a thing like this, affecting the lives of us all?"
For a moment, then, it had seemed to Paris that here, in the close heat of this rocky clearing where they stood, with the cicadas loud around them and the sun harsh on the blades of the palmetto, they were once more engaged in the old argument as to the relative merits of reason and nature that had occupied so much of their time aboard the Liverpool Merchant. But now the